Charm of Favor, Chapter 14.
"Hey, Jackie, how are you doing? I'm coming to your graduation, by the way," said James. "You better, and don't call me Jackie, asshole," said Jack. "Is that any way to talk to your oldest brother? Come on," said James. "The reason I called is that I wanted to tell you I applied to be a federal intern. My history teacher, Mr. Larson, I told you about him, awesome teacher. Anyway, he says he can get me into the Pentagon as an intern," said Jack, twisting her legs together. "The Pentagon? That's kind of fast track over there, but at least you won't get groped by those capital pukes," said James. "That's what I thought, too. I just wanted you to know, because you kind of work in this stuff," said Jack. "Oh, yeah, we love the pork and the road business," said James. "I'm not looking to make it a career or anything. I hate politics. But Mr. Larson has really taught us some things that explain why things are the way they are in Washington," said Jack. "Well, maybe you could teach me, because I've been up here for 5 years, and it feels like criminal from top to bottom," said James. "Oh, for sure. But he says that if good people take those jobs, then things will change," said Jack. "That's what they all say. They come here good, but after a few months, the dirt gets into everything and everyone. You start doing what everyone else does," said James. "What does that mean?" asked Jack. "You start looking out for number one. Everybody gets what they can get. And then, just when you think you can escape, you get sued or threatened with arrest. I don't know. It's like a game of blackmail, an invasion of privacy. It just gets weird," said James. "Well, anyway, I'm going to be taking the train to the Pentagon Monday morning for an interview. Maybe we could have lunch near the Smithsonian or something," said Jack. "That would be nice. But the president is speaking the following night, and we have a bunch of wining and dining to do. I think we're in Silver Springs that day," said James. "What's he speaking about?" "Not that I care," said Jack. "Bacon, bacon, bacon. He's got this whole energy thing he wants the taxpayers to pay for. This guy is going to shame Maytag out of business," said James. "What?" asked Jack. "They make washing machines. This guy can read a teleprompter. I'll say that for him," said James. "I don't get it. I'm not infected, remember?" "What are you talking about?" asked Jack. "Laundry, Jack. It's a game they play. Donors give money to the DNC. The president pays them back with a healthy profit using grants and shit with taxpayer money. It's done all the time. But taking a look at the lobbyist newsletter on this one tells me Obama's taking it to a whole new level," said James. "Isn't that illegal or something?" asked Jack. "It's SOP for DC," said James. "There you go again," said Jack. "Standard operating procedure. It's the way it works here. And they only have a few more weeks to line their pockets. And the election will bring in a whole new team of hungry appointees. Any way you look at it, the taxpayer gets hosed. But usually, it's more subtle," said James. "Like with the highway department?" chided Jack. "Hey, my clients build roads, bridges, and highways, and even airports. Most of that stuff lasts for 50 years or more. Besides, most of the money comes from the taxes on fuel that power the cars and trucks that use the stuff these guys build. It gets paid back a dozen times over. Seriously. Can you drive more than 25 miles anywhere in America and not see an orange barrel?" "No," said James. "So maybe this new energy thing will finally end up being the same way," said Jack. "You would hope so. But I don't think some solar company in Fremont, California is going to make a half $1 billion in tax revenue," said James. "You're kidding, right?" asked Jack. "I wish I was. Look, the way it works is that these bundlers go out and gather up a truckload of money pledges from these donors who want big grants and loan guarantees. The bundler goes to the DNC or to the president himself, sometimes, and turns in the pledges. I don't know what the going rate is, but it can be up to 50% of the award. Sometimes it's a repayment for something they did for them. It's like when Navistar bought that struggling bus company for $39 million. There was $39 million in Obama's grant package for Navistar. Eventually, they'll sell to some Indian or Chinese bus maker, and the money gets laundered nice and clean. In exchange, the Democrats get billions to run attack ads against Republicans, and that's the ballgame, said James. But all this is like under the table, right? Asked Jack. Oh, it used to be. Why do you think we lease an office on K Street? This is the meat market. I mean, this is where elected officials spend half their fundraising time. Why do you think the DC Ferrari dealership is the highest volume dealer in the country? This little empire here makes that shit happen, said James. A Ferrari isn't very smart if you're trying to hide the fact that you're getting filthy rich off of the taxpayers, said Jack. Oh, that's peanuts. A car is only a weekend perk. We're talking millions a year here. Everyone has been so deep for so long that no one will ever get caught because they're all in on the game. They won't bite the hand that feeds them, said James. I thought we fed them. Don't they work for us? Asked Jack. It's cost plus, said James, getting short with her. It's theft, said Jack. Yep, cost plus all you can take, said James. So what happens now, after tomorrow? Asked Jack. Look, I have to go here. My guess is that some solar panel company will get a screaming loan guarantee, borrow all the money, barely pay back the DNC, and go belly up. That's what I think, said James. I hope all those assholes get caught, said Jack. Oh, they will. But they'll all take the fifth before Congress. Everybody looks like they did their best, and nothing will ever be heard about it again, said James. Holy crap, said Jack. That's why they call this place the Swamp, said James. And tell me, why do I want to go to work in the Swamp? Asked Jack. Because your teacher's right, Jackie. We need good people to make it better, said James. Asshole, said Jack. I gotta go for now. I love you, little sister, said James. I love you too. Bye. And Jack hung up the phone. It begins with energy. We know the country that harnesses the power of clean, renewable energy will lead the 21st century. And yet, it is China that has launched the largest effort in history to make their economy energy efficient. We invented solar technology, but we've fallen behind countries like Germany and Japan in producing it. The new plug-in hybrids roll off our assembly lines, but they will run on batteries made in Korea. Well, I do not accept a future where jobs and industries of tomorrow take root beyond our borders, and I know you don't either. It is time for America to lead again. Thanks to our recovery plan, we will double this nation's supply of renewable energy in the next 3 years. We've also made the largest investment in basic research funding in American history, an investment that will spur not only new industries and discoveries in energy, but breakthroughs in medicine, in science, and technology. We will soon lay down thousands of miles of power lines that can carry new energy to cities and towns across this country. And we will put Americans to work making our homes and buildings more efficient so that we can save billions of dollars on our energy bills. But to truly transform our economy, to protect our security, and save our planet from the ravages of climate change, we need to ultimately make clean, renewable energy the profitable kind of energy. So, I ask this Congress to send me legislation that places a market-based cap on carbon pollution and drives the production of more renewable energy in America. That's what we need. And to support that innovation, we will invest $15 billion a year to develop technologies like wind, solar, advanced biofuels, clean coal, and more efficient cars and trucks built right here in America. That's an excerpt from President Barack Obama's speech to Congress, February 24, 2009. Monday came too quickly, as usual, and Jack decided to take the bus to the train station rather than walk. It made it easier to choose her blade heels to go with her black slacks. There was no chance she was walking 10 blocks in heels when it was 30 degrees outside anyway. By 7 a.m., she was through the cattle chutes at the station along with a couple hundred other commuters heading to work. The ride was quiet and smooth as it stopped the half a dozen stations before reaching the Pentagon. She checked her phone again for the name of the person that was meeting her and took the stairs up to the main entrance ramp. The employees swiped their badges and walked straight while she turned left to check in at the information desk. There was a small set of theater-style seats set up in front of a podium that had a large, official-looking plaque above it that said, United States Pentagon. She took a seat away from the other five contractor types dressed in suits laundered too many times. She pulled out her phone and checked her email and read a text message from her brother James saying, good luck. Jack Rousseau? Came a young male voice. That's me, said Jack as she stood up to greet the young Air Force major with a firm handshake. It's Miss Rousseau, said the major slowly, showing his surprise. Yes, Miss. I'm here for the intern interview, said Jack. Great. Come with me, please, said the major. The two walked to the manned security check station, and the major walked through with Jack close behind. She put her phone and pocketbook through the scanner and walked through the metal detector timidly. She smiled at the expressionless green uniform and picked up her pocketbook and phone to continue walking with the major. The first hallway was as wide as some streets with office doors and shops along both sides. The ceilings were more than 12 feet high, and she got the feeling that even if this place got busy, there would be plenty of room to move around. Whoever designed this building wanted visitors to feel small and powerless. On any given day, there were close to 4,000 people that worked in the Pentagon. There was a Starbucks and a barbershop on one side and what looked like a couple of courtrooms on the other side. They came to an intersection and turned left down a hallway that was only about 2 cars wide for the 50 yards and entered another intersection where they turned right. She could see the layout in her mind as 5 five-sided rings, one inside the other. The further in they went, the more stars she saw on the shoulders of the people in the hallways. This is it. Have a seat, and the general will be with you shortly, said the major. She sat carefully and didn't cross her legs. A general, she mused, as she raised her eyebrows for a moment. She reached into her pocket and turned off her phone and looked around the ante-room of the small suite. The light-colored wood paneling looked dated, and the furnishings were gray and made of metal. It's not even as nice as the dentist office, she thought to herself. Almost without a sound, a lean man in a light blue shirt with dark blue pants with a stripe down the outside walked into the room and gave her a polite nod. The 4 chrome stars on his shoulders sparkled under the fluorescent lights as he passed her and walked straight to the rear of the suite and into the open doorway. She thought she heard talking, but it was too soft and polite to make out the words. Within moments, he reemerged and walked past her again, glancing at her with clear blue eyes. A pilot, she thought. 4 stars. Maybe even an astronaut. Miss Rousseau, it's nice to finally meet you, came the female voice walking toward her. Yes, same here, General, started Jack as she rose to her feet. You are tall, aren't you? Tommy told me all about you, but he didn't say you were so tall, said the general. Oh, it's the heels. I'm only 5'10", said Jack. I'm General Stacy Banks. People call me all kinds of things, I think. But you can call me General Banks, okay? Said General Banks. Yes, yes, ma'am, General, said Jack, stumbling over her words. It's fine. Come on in, have a seat, and let's talk about things, said General Banks. Jack took a deep breath and walked into the general's office. The wood paneling was the same, but there were pictures of rockets and billowing clouds coming out of buildings made of blue and gray steel. In the bookcase behind the desk was a photo of a small football team with a ribbon hanging over the corner. Below that were a crystal trophy of some kind and a tiny model of a space shuttle on a mahogany stand. The desk was cleared except for a single screen and a keyboard along with a speaker and a phone. She chose the left seat and sat carefully into it and slid back so her spine was straight. She fought the urge to cross her legs and suddenly felt inside like she was balancing on the balls of her feet, waiting for the first move. "You go by Jack, is that right?" asked the general, sitting heavily in her chair. "Yes, General," said Jack. "Generals are like aircraft carriers. They have carrier groups made of a dozen ships, 100 planes, subs, and even spacecraft that are part of their command structure. We're the same way. I have 171 staff members led from here and stationed in Mississippi, Florida, and places I can't share with you. My command is responsible for protecting America as part of the Department of Homeland Security, began General Banks. It sounded, for a brief moment, like an excerpt from a speech or a formal presentation, until she smiled and leaned back in her large, brown leather office chair. I'm sure we're safe, said Jack, searching for something to say. Well, we're not. We not only have to watch our enemies outside the country, we have to watch our enemies inside the country, and some of them we can't do a damn thing about, said General Banks. Inside the country? Asked Jack, instantly wishing she had said nothing. As my intern, your job will be to run for me. And believe me, there's a lot of running in this place. Ditch those heels. When you come back to work, let's see, when is that? Said the general, thumbing through a yellow pad on her desk. The 5th of April, it says here. When you come back, wear black sneakers instead of black heels. You'll be doing about 5 miles a day in this place. Is that okay? Asked General Banks, as though it was an order. Yes, General, said Jack, smiling slightly now. She was worried she would be stuck at a desk or filing papers all day. The fact there was some physical activity with the job made her already feel more comfortable with the job. And lose your phone. No phones in here. When you come back. Major, would you come in here for a moment? Said General Banks, directing her voice toward the door without raising it even slightly. Yes, General Banks, said the Major, stepping slightly into the doorway. This is Major Meade. He came to us from Missile Command, one of our many adjustments we've had to make with the recent budget changes, said General Banks, not hiding her resentment. He is going to take you through the rest of your orientation. You'll be squared away by, about 1,200 or so. It was nice meeting you, she said, standing without much effort and gripping Jack's hand more than firmly. Major Meade turned his shined low quarters on the balls of his feet, and the two of them walked out into the hallway and turned left to the first intersection. This time they headed into the inner ring of the Pentagon. That's not what I expected, said Jack finally. A female general? Asked Major Meade. No, I mean, not really that. She was intense. I mean, threats in the country and stuff? She had a spacecraft on her shelf, said Jack, as they walked smoothly. He was the same height as her, even with her heels, and he was lean with pale skin. He probably hadn't seen sunshine in a year, she thought. It's the X-37B, said the Major. A space shuttle? Asked Jack, not really sure to what she was referring. Sort of. It was an unmanned space shuttle NASA was working on. When the budget cuts came, and believe me, they were like a meat cleaver, they dropped the project. We acquired it within 24 hours and rolled it into our rapid deployment budget. Off the books, of course. We made a number of them, and there's always one in space, as we speak, said Major Meade. What do they do? Asked Jack. Can't tell you, said Major Meade. I know, that's classified, said Jack, making quotation marks in the air with her fingers. Well, yeah. But I can't tell you anyway, because I have no clue what it does, said Major Meade. You work for the general that owns the project, and you don't know what it does? That's spooky, said Jack, as they turned right down the inner ring of the Pentagon and headed for an open door facing the outside courtyard of the building. It's not up there for nothing. The most expensive cargo bay in the world, trust me. They don't waste it. Here we are, said Major Meade, standing aside to let her go in first. He came in close behind her and stood next to her at attention. She didn't know how to stand at attention, so she put her feet together and her hands at her side. The room faced a large plate-glass window, outside of which was a sort of sitting garden. There were a few trees, some flowers, and a small pond with lilies floating in the water. She couldn't help but wonder how out of place it looked. Like it was planet Earth on display the way it used to be before mankind had destroyed it. Come on in, Major, came the deep voice from the office to the right of the empty receptionist desk. Major Meade motioned slightly with his head, and he stepped forward with his left foot like he was marching into a parade review. Jack followed close behind. "Sir, this is," began Major Meade. "I know who this is." "Hello, Jack," said the deep, smooth voice. Jack was tall for a woman. She could look most men in the eye, and the taller ones, when she wore heels. He stood close to 7 feet tall, and he had a full head of light, smooth, blonde hair. His skin was normal pink, and he didn't look a day over 40. She tried to detect if he colored his hair like so many men his age. His suit was perfectly tailored for his tall, lean frame, and he extended his hand toward her. She stepped forward and placed her hand in his, but it was so large she couldn't grip it the way her brothers practiced with her. She felt like a little girl, not knowing how to grip it or even hold it. Her breath stopped for a moment, and then she felt her heart resume its rhythm. "Nice to meet you," she said quietly. "My name is Raymond Knorr. I think quite a bit of your Mr. Larson, Tommy." "Very capable young man," said Raymond, releasing her hand and gracefully motioning for her to take a seat. "Thank you, Major," he said, glancing barely at the Major. "Yes, sir. Just call when," began Major Meade, knowing it was not necessary for him to finish. He turned on his heel again, with his thumbs tucked neatly beside his index fingers, and made long and smooth strides to leave. "Tell me something about yourself, Miss Rousseau," said Raymond, as he sat in an enormous black leather chair behind a desk that was at least a foot higher than a normal desk. "Jack is fine with me. What would you like to know?" asked Jack. She had learned at a young age to ask questions about other people first. A young girl, maturing quickly, learns that understanding is a powerful weapon that can be used against you. "It's always better to know your opponent more," Lisa would tell her. "And remember this, for a woman, everyone is your opponent." "What is your purpose, for one?" asked Raymond. "I guess I don't know yet. That's a big question," said Jack, feeling her face flush as she stepped back in her mind and planted her rear foot. "That's a good answer, actually." "Do you know who you are?" asked Raymond. "I am my father's daughter," said Jack smoothly. "Do you know what we do here?" asked Raymond. "Besides bomb the shit out of half the world and borrow money from the rest?" "No, not really," said Jack, almost regretting the words like she had spilled a drink on the floor. "Well done, Jack. The truth is that we are at war with the most powerful being in the universe. He wants our world, all of it, every living soul on it. And we mean to fight him, and we seek victory," said Raymond, barely swiveling his chair toward her. His eyes were calm, and there were no stress lines around them. The blue was disarming, but peaceful. His voice was deeper than anyone she had ever heard that wasn't in a movie. "You mean God? You're at war with God?" asked Jack, in disbelief that he would even say a word like universe. "He thinks so," said Raymond, pausing, not moving his eyes from hers. "No, I'm afraid we're on our own when it comes to divine intervention, Jack. But we have something he does not have, and he means to take it from us by any means possible." "You're talking about the devil? You're kidding, right?" asked Jack, shifting in her chair under his eyes, revealing her, watching the air in her lungs. "It took us a few hundred years to figure out the rules, what's possible and what is not, for him and for us. He is powerful beyond words, but he has limitations. We have escaped a few times, made changes, looked at the future, and decided to take different paths to survive. It takes time. Sometimes 100 years for him to adapt to those changes. But he is relentless, and there is never a shortage of people who want what he offers," said Raymond. "Am I in the right place?" asked Jack after a painful silence. "Yes. It was time for us to meet. Our Mr. Larson has been aware of you for a long time," the words coming quietly now, like a pillow resting against her face. What was he waiting for? What do you mean? Asked Jack, barely able to balance in this match. Choice, Jack, said Raymond. What? I don't understand, said Jack, shaking her head slightly. Your drive for sovereignty, the way you changed even your name. You saw your brothers as competitors, not protectors. You are your own person, not blown about with every wind of doctrine, affecting the universe with purpose. We want to show you a purpose, said Raymond. You keep saying we. Who is we? Are we? Asked Jack. I'm afraid we are small in number. Scarce, in fact. Mortality is something souls do not often understand. It is heaven for some and hell for others, often living in the same neighborhood, sometimes sleeping in the same bed or dying in the same war. Life is special in the universe, requiring untold amounts of energy and planning to make it possible. It can sprinkle our existence with immeasurable joy or splatter it with unspeakable horror. What is your purpose, Jack? Asked Raymond again, this time the words piercing her heart, begging an answer like a child looking up at its mother. To be free, to help people be free, said Jack as the tears welled in her eyes. That is correct. Now, our enemy has different plans. He offers wealth and power in this world to souls who come here. His soldiers are everywhere, and they are bound to him by their own choice. A few he protects and enriches as they rise in power and usefulness to his purpose. Others he betrays at the end of their duty, and they seal the contract with their own blood, said Raymond. Who are they? Asked Jack, drawing her composure back as though a piece of powerful music had ended. The leaders are easy to see, but the ones in secret are nearly impossible to fight. We finally defeated all their armies, but they changed their tactics and went deep underground. They're buried inside our own government now, and they are getting bolder by the day. There are hundreds of their soldiers inside this very building. There are thousands at the other end of that train tunnel, said Raymond. What can I do? Asked Jack. I cannot tell you that. Rules, Jack. It only counts if we do it correctly, said Raymond. I don't know what to do, said Jack, fighting the urge to put her face in her hands or cross her arms. When you return, I mean to put you in harm's way. I cannot promise your safety, but I can tell you that victory is possible, said Raymond. I'm not afraid of dying, said Jack without thinking. I have a feeling you already know the answer to that, said Raymond, as he reached up to the phone and pressed a button for a moment. It made no sound. There was no voice. I'm going to kick Mr. Larson's ass, though, said Jack, smiling. Bigger men than you have tried, said Raymond, smiling and standing gracefully from his leather chair. I look forward to our next meeting, Jack. General Banks is a great woman. We'll see you in a few months, he said, reaching for her hand. Are you ready, Miss Rousseau? Asked Major Meade, standing in the doorway. We have one more meeting. How are you holding up? I'm fine. A little scared, but I'm doing okay, said Jack. You're young, but I think you'll understand more in a few minutes, said Major Meade. Who was that guy? I mean, Raymond. He was a civilian, but he's like spooky or something, said Jack. That's above my pay grade, I'm afraid. Even if I did know, I'm not the one to tell you about it, said Major Meade as they wound their way from the inner ring of the Pentagon through the halls to the other side of the building. The general wasn't kidding that there would be miles of walking in this building as part of her internship. She began to regret wearing the heels already. She had already lost her bearings and didn't know if they were close to the entrance, near the train station or not, as they made the turn from one of the smaller connector passageways into another main hallway. They stopped in front of a metal door. It looked like a vault of some kind and had a number pad on the outside. The major did not punch in any numbers. On either side of the door were a set of light curtains and what looked like an armored camera with a thick lens over it. Within seconds, the door made a loud click and began to open. A Marine in desert camouflage opened it wide and stuck out his hand to shake the major's hand. "Morning, Major Meade. Is this Jack?" he asked shortly. "Yes, sir. Is he ready?" asked Major Meade. "Yes, sir. Please step inside, sir," said the Marine. The two of them stepped inside the door, and the Marine closed the door. A series of audible clicks told her the area was not accessible without someone letting you in. The room had cement unpainted walls with sealed light fixtures connected with shiny metal conduit against the high ceiling. The floors were painted with a kind of non-skid gray epoxy, and there was no furniture. The door on the other side was also of the same steel design that clicked loudly as they approached it. "This room is airtight, except for those nozzles on the ceiling," said Major Meade. "I guess I don't want to know what they're for," said Jack timidly as they walked into the next section. "No, you do not," said Major Meade. They turned left and passed through a metal detector and down a hallway to another open room. It was full of cubicles filled with people of all ranks wearing different uniforms. She could hear muffled speaking as it appeared to be a calling center where information was being fused from a constant flow of intelligence. "Is this where I'll be working?" asked Jack. "No, ma'am. This area was destroyed on September 11th, 2001. It's been remodeled." "Here we are," said Major Meade as they reached the back of the cubicle center. He held out his hand to introduce her to the room. "Hello, Jackie," came the familiar voice. "Rocky? Holy crap, you gotta be kidding me," said Jack, reaching out to hug her older brother. "Thanks, Major. See you in about 20 minutes," asked Rocky as the Major saluted and left the room. "Have a seat, little sister." "I thought you were in the Navy," said Jack, sitting without the same trepidation she had felt in the General's office. "It's all the same soup, I'm afraid. Officially, the Navy. But intelligence is growing so fast we had to pull the best and most loyal talent from everywhere we can. That's why you're here. Mr. Larson is a good teacher, don't you think?" asked Rocky. "He scares the shit out of me sometimes. I mean, you get history behind the history, you know?" asked Jack, sitting on her hands in the gray upholstered chair. "Yeah, well, we put him in there for a reason. Let's just leave it at that. Listen, Jackie, America's at war. I don't mind telling you that we have a real problem on our hands, and that's why I wanted you here with me. There's a chance this whole thing could go south on us. No kidding here. We have been compromised at the highest levels, and it's bad. It's worse than anyone thought it could get," said Rocky, sitting on his desk in front of her. "I want to help. I mean, I know you're just trying to keep me safe inside this brick shithouse, but you have me here. Now put me to work. How bad is it? I mean, are the Russians going to nuke us or something?" asked Jack. "They don't need to. Look, Jackie, the bad guys got rid of all the people who have been fighting them for 30 years, ever since the turn of the century. We were looking for Y2K, and they nearly destroyed us while we were chasing our tails. They told us carbon dioxide was the greatest threat to the survival of the planet, and they stole trillions of dollars, got the gold, and nearly took control of the whole damn thing," said Rocky. "You mean global warming?" asked Jack. Rocky rubbed his hands into his face for a moment and then folded his arms. "Our enemy has been planning for centuries to capture the human race. His generals are handpicked and groomed for their greed, and he uses them to accomplish his mission. They're powerful beyond belief. Hell, we elected a few of them president, and there are hundreds working inside the government within a couple miles of here every day. And these people are pure evil. A soldier kills to save his brothers in arms. These people kill because they enjoy it, and not just from a distance. They savor watching the life drain out of a person in front of them. They're like serial killers who rape, abuse, and murder like it tastes good. We can't win against people like that. You can't put them in jail because the judges are loyal to this beast. You can't make a treaty with them. There is no contract. There is no surrender. They are forcing us to take an action we cannot take. Because if we take it, we will follow them to hell, said Rocky. You sound like that Raymond guy. He was talking about the devil or something, said Jack. I didn't used to think there was any such thing. Society goes through this cycle, repeating history over and over. After a war, we have peace, and that peace goes on for a while until people begin to prosper again. A generation or two, and then people forget about the war. They don't know what death smells like anymore, and then a few people break the law. But generally, society is merciful. We hire and train police to take care of the lawbreakers. But the way it works is, we incarcerate them or deport them. We separate them from society until one day they get too numerous. And the people demand justice. And then we go to war again. Peace, mercy, justice, and war. Over and over again. But this time, war won't work, said Rocky. Why? Why can't we just fight them and win? Asked Jack, trying to understand what her brother was telling her. Because if we had a war like that, it would be everywhere. It would be on every street. It would be almost in every house, for Christ's sake. People would be fighting everywhere. It's just not possible, said Rocky. So, you're saying we've already lost? Asked Jack. Winning is an individual thing, I'm afraid. But my job here is to see if we can save America. If they succeed in ending this country, and they're getting damn close, then there won't be any getting it back. If we can save this, we will have saved the world, said Rocky, sliding off his desk onto his feet. I want to help, Rocky, said Jack. I'm not trying to recruit you. I'm trying to protect you. Something big is coming, and I don't know what it is, said Rocky. Why? I mean, why now? Asked Jack. Because we know about them. Because we know who their generals are. We have been finally approved to go after them. The issue is that they know this. Because they have people in the White House. Hell, they could take the president out with a moment's notice, said Rocky. Doesn't he have the Secret Service or something? Asked Jack. Yeah, secret shit. Those guys get about as much training as you've had. They train for nothing. They stand for nothing. They have no command structure. Hell, they may have assassins in their ranks as we speak, and they know it. And they don't give a shit. All they have to do is stand out of the way for 1 minute, and it's over, Jackie. The FBI, the CIA, the NSA, they're all compromised with these guys. The only ones we can trust are right in that room outside this door, said Rocky, pacing the floor. Is that what Raymond does? He knows, doesn't he? Asked Jack. There are souls you don't have to watch over. A few people will do the right thing even when no one is watching. They remember something way beyond all this crap. I would like to say no amount of money would tempt them, but Jack, the ones I'm talking about don't even know what money is. The concept of wealth is not in their reality. Dad was like that. When everyone else was having one or two kids after they were in their second house, he believed in us and brought us here. That's why you're here. That's why I'm here, and James and Mike as well. I have to believe there are hundreds of thousands like us here on this planet. But we have been quiet and peaceful. But the time for silence has passed. The time to stand up and be counted has come, said Rocky. Aren't you supposed to, like, ride up and down in front of the troops on a horse while you're saying all this? Asked Jack, smiling. I don't know how to ride a horse, said Rocky, smiling back at her. Me neither. You coming to my graduation? Asked Jack, eager to change the subject. I wouldn't miss it. There are some things that are really important, you know, said Rocky. Oh, yeah. You're in a freaking fortress playing Battleship, and I'm graduating from high school. How does that even compare? Asked Jack. Every time I walk out of this place, I wonder if I will ever come back. Believe me when I tell you this. There's no peaceful transfer of power in America. These two powers are at war, right now, for the very soul of this country, said Rocky. You're making my point for me, said Jack. What does it matter if we win the war and lose our soul? I'm coming to your graduation, said Rocky, as he picked up his phone and dialed three numbers. You gonna have jets fly over? Asked Jack, standing up to hug him as he put the phone down. How about if I send the moon over, nice and slow? Asked Rocky, hugging her tightly. There was a soft knock at the door frame as Rocky patted her solidly between the shoulder blades. That Taekwondo is making you solid there, except for what's left of that black eye, said Rocky, letting her go. You should see the other guy. Hey, Major Meade. Looks like we're all family now, said Jack, turning to walk with him. Yes, ma'am. You ready to go? Asked Major Meade. I'm ready. You can call me Jack. Ma'am is my mom, said Jack. Take a look out there, Jack. Most of my people are not much older than you. It's a new generation of warriors, only we use cyber bullets, said Rocky. Why not? Gamers, right? Asked Jack, looking out into the cubicle area. The only difference is, you only get one life, said Rocky soberly. Come on, let's move out, Jack, said Major Meade. See you later, Rocky, said Jack. Rocky? Asked Major Meade, raising an eyebrow and looking at Rocky. Don't get any ideas, Major. See you in a few weeks, Jack, said Rocky. It was further than she expected when they arrived at the entrance to the Pentagon. Her feet were throbbing in the zipped-up heels as the soldier in a black uniform looked at her phone and pocketbook. She okay, Major? Asked the soldier. Her phone has been turned off the entire time. Orientation, said the Major. Very good, sir. Ma'am, said the soldier as he handed them back to Jack on the outside of the metal detector. Thanks. Well, I'll see you in about 6 weeks, Major Meade, said Jack as she shook his hand. I know you'll say you'll be fine, but can I send someone with you to get you home safely? Said the Major. Looks like I'm already home. See you later, said Jack as she turned to walk toward the stairs leading down to the train station. It was just around noon, and she was hungry, but there were very few people on the stairs. She figured it would be easier to beat the rush and make it home before the city went crazy with traffic. She dropped her train ticket into the slot, and the gates opened smoothly to let her onto the terminal. The air was icy under the ground, and the electric sign displayed 5 minutes and 30 seconds before the next train arrived. There were two policemen talking casually by the vending machines, and one was sipping something steamy from a small cup. She shook her head slightly and folded her arms in amazement at seeing her brother working in the Pentagon. It crossed her mind to tell her father that he was right, and she sniffed back the urge to cry suddenly when she realized he couldn't tell anyone if she did. The train arrived in silence, and with the recorded female voice telling everyone to stand behind the yellow line until the train doors opened, she took a seat near the door and pulled out her phone to turn it on. Within a few seconds, its screen flicked on, and the train began to accelerate toward the first stop at the Smithsonian. She sent a text to her mother, letting her know she was on her way home and was craving a grilled cheese sandwich. She leaned back and stretched her legs out for the few minutes it would take to get to her stop. She closed her eyes and rotated her ankles against the leather of her zipped-up heels. She thought about high school being over soon, and where all this fit into her dream of going to college. Maybe it didn't matter anymore. Maybe things moved so fast and knowledge was so available all the time that she didn't need an old, obsolete professor telling her the way he thought things should be, and they weren't that way at all. Maybe it was time she decided the way things would be for herself. She closed her eyes and realized that she didn't even know enough to know the right questions to ask. She thought of Tommy Larson. Yeah, that was it. When she woke up, the train was at the end of the line, 2 stops past her station. It didn't matter. She could wait it out. Trains were a safe place in D.C.